Last week, we introduced 15 new members to this church, but four of them, because of illness or some other reason, were not able to be present. So we took them into membership in absentia, but they are present this morning. And I would like to have them stand when I call their names so that you can fix names and faces and give them a special welcome when the service is over. They are Louise and George Bromley, who are right here, and Betty and John Brookover, who are just behind them. So please tell them later how happy you are that they also are a part of this fellowship. Once upon a time, we remembered sensational events a little longer than we do now. The TV set bombards us with so many tragedies in living color that we can only register shock for a few hours or at most a few days before we're swamped by all the other tragedies that keep coming at us from our electronic guest. Our attention span is not very long. One of the national magazines mentioned last week how excited the country was about a year and a half ago when athletes Lynn Bias and Don Rogers died of cocaine. For a while, the drug problem was bigger than the economy, bigger even than threats of war, and politicians, as you would expect, quickly responded. The Reagans did a TV talk supporting an anti-drug crusade. Congress appropriated nearly $2 billion to fund the fight, and for a while, optimism seemed possible. By now, we've passed on to a half dozen other problems, although the drug traffic is worse than ever. Dealers on the big city streets say that the police only pressure them for a while after the shouting, and then they let up. More cocaine is coming now than ever, and the demand is up. We consumed 72 metric tons in 1985. But that story is old hat. It doesn't make the front page anymore. All of which I said only to point out that the brief little sensation which led me to this sermon has already passed on and is being forgotten. For a few days, I think most of us felt a special empathy with that amnesia victim who woke up on a Wichita street one day with no idea how he got there, no idea who he was, absolutely cut off from all human or territorial connections that would give him some clue to identity. Fortunately for him, he had some good help, and he began to recall a few things, and one memory led to another until his people were found in Canada and came for him. He was not Henry, after all, which was the name we had given him, and we all thought there was a happy ending until we heard about a love triangle that might have caused his trauma. At which point, my guess is we will hear no more about Henry while he tries to put his life back together. But while he was in the hospital and on television, with that look of desperate confusion in his eyes, I'm sure most of you felt his terrible plight in the same way I did, except that being a person who has to look for truth in the human dilemma so it can be brought into the pulpit, I kept thinking about Henry until I woke up one morning at 3:30 with the realization that I wanted to say something about him and the whole business of identity. I've learned that if I go back to sleep without making notes, everything is gone in the morning. So I keep a large notepad and a pen beside the bed that allow me to reach down quietly in the darkness and scratch out a few key words. It would be much easier to turn on the light, but I think you understand why that is not an option. So a few words are scratched down about identity. And then in the morning, I take a short walk and think about it some more. I remember a few times when I woke up from some deep, exhausted sleep, a nap taken at some unusual time, and how for a moment or so I had no idea about the day or the hour, where I was, or how I got there. That isn't a very pleasant feeling, even when it lasts only for a couple of minutes. Imagine what it would be like if you got up and moved around and looked at things and still had no idea where you were, no idea who you were. Near total disorientation is one of the worst things an otherwise healthy human being can experience. So as I kept on walking, I tried to imagine Henry saying to himself, in mounting terror, who am I? Who am I? I can hardly imagine anything more frightening than not being able to answer that question. But then another thought occurred to me. I realized that I haven't always known who I am. Now, before you chalk that up as a bit of early morning madness, I want you to think about it. Have you ever thought something and a moment later ask yourself, did I really think that? Have you ever said or done something and later ask yourself, did I do that? Did that really come out of my mouth? We think we know who we are, and all of a sudden we do such an unlikely thing that we aren't sure. I've had people tell me in counseling sessions that they have come in from doing something particularly shameful or mean and looked into the mirror and seen a stranger looking back and have stumbled out of the room saying, who am I? In the name of God, who am I? Fortunately, that feeling is rare for most of us, so I suppose we don't have to dwell on it. But once we start talking about identity, we get into the whole business of how we establish one in the first place. So on the morning of my walk, I got to thinking about that too, and it wasn't hard to know where to start. The only identity I had at first was that I was my father's and mother's child. For a few years, no doubt someone would see me and say, who is that kid? And someone else would say, because there was not much else to say, oh, that's Bill Myers' boy. And they said his name instead of my mother's, because in our little world, he had more identity than she did. Most of what I did in my childhood was related to creating a more complex identity than that for myself. When I found out how much I liked to talk, I agreed with a desperate teacher's suggestion that maybe I'd like to tell stories to the class. And there was a new identity, class storyteller. When my sister was in classes of her own, where people knew only her, then I got another identity. I was Eileen's brother. And that's how it goes all the rest of our lives. We are identified by the people we are related to, by the friends we have, by the work we do, by the clubs we belong to, until there is a vast and intricate web of connections. And if any one of those strings is touched, the vibration ends somewhere inside us, and we respond appropriately. There are even times when we wish we could shuck off our identity completely and be somebody else just for a while. I remember a day when a friend and I discovered that if we went up on top of my dad's three-story furniture building, it was possible to dangle a long string with a blunt hook on it and lift off very neatly the hats of men who were passing by down on the sidewalk. A couple of the victims looked up and laughed, but the third one went into the store. And my dad came out, and I wanted desperately to be somebody else. Apparently, even grown people do not always have a strong sense of identity, because some of our friends still seem to be in search of one. I knew a man in another church who could never talk without cataloging for you every single one of his accomplishments since the last time you met him. Not just a few, like most of us, but all of them. It was pathological. He was terribly insecure. He was not sure who he was, or if he guessed, he didn't like who he was. Every teacher watches children in the classroom working at the identity business. I see them even in college, wearing unbelievable clothes and purple hair, trying to establish an identity in the midst of the crowd. We may smile at some of that, but it's essential. We have to have some notion of who we are, and we have to establish that notion in the minds of people around us. I remember that one of the great moral imperatives of Greek civilization was summed up in just two words: know thyself. Know who you are, know what you are. The end of knowledge, perhaps the beginning of it as well. When the English picked up Greek ideas during the Renaissance in the 16th century, they made much of that old know thyself idea. So Shakespeare has one of King Lear's daughters say of him, and it is a biting criticism, "He hath always but slenderly known himself." That's quite an indictment. He doesn't know who he is, and he ought to by now. Sometimes, as you know, a person comes along with so many identities that life turns into a nightmare. You may remember the three faces of Eve years ago, and you may have seen the follow-up story last week on that same woman who is now cured. The conflicts set up by her multiple identities tore her to pieces, put her into therapy, ruined her life. That kind of thing is so rare it doesn't worry us much. But in quieter ways, conflicting signals about who we are can damage any one of us. If the self you know to be real is quite different from the self you have presented to the rest of us. And if you have to juggle those two constantly to keep from being found out, the effort can wear you out. Deception is an expensive business. But there can also be so much conformity to what the majority thinks that life is just as surely spoiled. By coincidence, while identity was on my mind, my class had a poem to read called The Unknown Citizen. The poet's pretense in that poem is that some nameless but typical man has been buried and that his life can be described like this. Never a complaint lodged against him by anyone. Purely negative virtue. No complaints. A man who in everything he did served the greater community, capital G, capital C. Not God, or whatever may be represented by the word, but the majority and their opinions. Except for the war, till the day he died, he worked in a factory and never got fired. The press are convinced that he bought a paper every day and that his reactions to advertisements were normal in every way. He was fully sensible of the advantages of the installment plan and had everything necessary to the modern man. Our researchers into public opinion are content that he held the proper opinions for the time of year. When there was peace, he was for peace. When there was war, he went. The poem ends by asking, was he free? Was he happy? The question is absurd. Had anything been wrong, we should certainly have heard. Actually, everything was wrong because the person had no identity at all. Might just as well have been only a number, and in fact is identified that way in the subheading to the poem, to JS07M378, this marble monument is erected by the state. Now, if you wonder why I am talking so much about identity from a pulpit, my answer is this: the ultimate parody of the Christian faith is to turn a person into a number, to forget uniqueness, to reduce the concept of character to a few standard opinions adopted by the crowd. In the same week, we read another modern poem called Mr. Z, about a light-skinned black man who decided he could advance himself best by denying his origins and passing as white. So he turned his back on jazz and spirituals, chose a raceless opinion for every situation, ate white food instead of soul food. He married a Jewish girl who, also being in the minority, decided to change her identity as well. They were married by an Episcopalian priest who pronounced them not husband and wife, but matched chameleons. And so they went through life, climbing, the poem says, unclogged by ethnic weights, airborne plants, flourishing without roots. It didn't work, and their lives ended in bitterness. There has to be an identity, and it has to be one that strikes deeply into the whole truth about yourself so that you can present it without strain. Identity may be thrust upon you at first, but by and by you choose it. Some of our religious neighbors have made us wary of the phrase born again, but it remains a sound theological and psychological idea. We can find a better identity if we wish. Here's how it was put once in the scripture Donna Kochner read to you. Jesus was in the world, but the world did not recognize him. He entered into the realm that belonged to him, and his own world did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, to those who yielded him their allegiance, he gave the power to become sons and daughters of God. You have asked me to remind you of that so that it won't be forgotten. You have more than one identity. You come as lawyers, physicians, teachers, businessmen and women, homemakers, clerks, builders, but you come here and worship here because you are the sons and daughters of God. What we are supposed to do when we leave is remember all week who we are.